All right, so we are in Perek Yud Gimel, Pasuk Tet Vav, chapter 13, sentence 15. We'll dedicate the learning for Refuah Shlema for Pesach David Ben Edel. Sure, Refuah Shlema. Okay, we begin, remember, in the middle of a story in which Yonatan has plunged the Jews into a very difficult position. Shaul is Melech. Shaul was duly anointed. Everybody has now accepted him. He has a force of 2,000 men who are his entourage, army, whatever else he's using them for, unclear. Yonatan has another 1,000. He dismisses the Jews from Gilgal, sends everybody home. He's ready to set up his base of operations in a place called Michmas. And then Yonatan goes and kills the local Plishti governor. Governor isn't quite the right word. There isn't really a good English word that I can think of. I wonder if consul isn't in some sense the word, but consul sounds diplomatic, and this really isn't diplomatic. It's basically the local Plishti, I don't know, warlord may be a better term.
Someone, that's what I was thinking of.
Chieftain, maybe.
Somebody chieftain, because he doesn't have his own independent status. He's a function of the Plishti hierarchy, but on the other hand, he has authority over everything that's going on locally, and he's a powerful person, and Yonatan assassinates him. And
magistrate?
I don't know. Magistrate sounds very judicial to me, and I don't get the impression that he's doing a whole lot of judging. I don't know, plenipotentiary, right? Whatever powers we want to throw on him, this is what he has. He's a nitzav, matzav. We use a couple of different related terms for him. In any case, Yonatan starts a war. We aren't really clear. We talked about this already before. We aren't really clear on what he was doing. We saw Radak and Abarbanel that he actually wanted to start a war. Malbim notes explicitly that this is not on Shaul's orders. Shaul sent everybody home, you know, expecting that this was going to be a time of relative peace. But Yonatan does this, and now the nation is in trouble, and Shaul rallies the nation, and the people hear that, or at least it seems they hear that Shaul did it. That's what the text says. Radak says either they assumed that it was on Shaul's instructions, that he had told Yonatan to do it, but either way, whether it was Shaul himself that they heard about, or that they just assumed that Yonatan was acting on Shaul's orders, the people respond initially, and they rally in the thousands until the Plishtim rally, and at that point the Jews realize we are way outnumbered. And at that point they go running for whatever they can find. Some people hide in caves, holes, tunnels, whatever it is. Other people flee east of the Yarden, but no one wants anything to do with the Plishtim. Shaul is trying to get ready for war, and he is worried because his force of 2,000 has now become a force of 600. People are leaving, and he is scared. Remember, we had the instruction from Shmuel back in Perek Yud saying that you're going to have to wait 7 days and then I'm going to come bring korbanot. Not mention anything about, oh, by the way, there's going to be a war going on at this point. Just like this is what you're supposed to do after Gilgal. And Shaul waits and waits and waits. And then, depending on which commentator you take, either on day 7 or after day 7, he brings the korbanot himself, preparation for going to war. Shmuel then shows up and says, that was a very bad mistake. And he says, your monarchy, your power is not going to continue to your descendants as a result of this mistake that you made. He does not say, as we noted, he does not say you're losing the throne. He just says it's not going on to your descendants. The
a lot of times where they'll say, it's going to come, but because you this, I'll let you finish up yours.
Correct. Yeah, although he doesn't say that to him explicitly either. We will get some who get that. Shlomo gets that, for example, in Malachim.
This is prior to Amalek's situation.
This is the chapter before.
He's already said he's not going to continue.
Yes, that's correct.
I missed that.
Okay, I highly, highly recommend that people catch the audios when they miss, because there's important information in there. But yes, this is before the Amalek story. Yes, Susan.
It's sort of like, I think,
right, so we asked that. Right, so we asked that question when we first learned this. Is this a setup, and was this in fact anticipated, that this was what was going to happen? And we said, not necessarily. We said that, according to most of the commentators, had Shaul succeeded in his mission, had he followed, then monarchy would have remained with him and with his descendants. He's not a fall guy, in other words. Hashem knows everything, but Hashem sets us up all the time in positions that we fail in. Are you going to tell me now that he should have created robots, and then we would never fail? Right. So again, go back to what we said last week about why this is such a big deal. Right. We discussed this question of why this is such a big deal. Why does he deserve to lose the position? And what we said, after he gave his whole explanation and so forth, what we explained was that, number one, we discount the idea that Halbertal puts forth that Shmuel is actually undermining Shaul, because Shmuel, just the opposite, pleads with God on behalf of Shaul. This is not a personal thing against Shaul, and not to mention the fact that if Shmuel doesn't like the monarchy, then he wouldn't have said, and God's going to appoint a new king. He would have said, power comes back to me. So we can discount the idea that this is somehow Shmuel's own thing. Okay. The second idea, which Rashi put forth, is just look back at the book of Devarim. Built into the job description of the king is Levilti Surman Hamitzvaya Menu Smol. He's not allowed to stray from the divine command, and if he does, he's going to face the consequences. And we saw that in Radak. Abarbanel notes that Shmuel said to him, I'm going to tell you what to do, which includes the war. And you have to listen when the Navi speaks to you. Abarbanel thinks there's a death penalty for violating what a prophet says. To which we also noted the whole controversy of having a king, right? The fact that from the very beginning, we were told that the people want a king, and Hashem says their desire for a king is ultimately a rejection of me. They don't want me to rule them. But I'm going to have the last laugh, because the king is going to be responsible to me. The king who doesn't follow what I tell him to do is out. Hang on one second. So within this theory, within this understanding, it actually, as difficult as it is for us to grasp the idea that it's one strike and you're out, but this is what the monarchy is all about. It's supposed to be a person who is going to communicate from Hashem what the nation is supposed to do and is going to listen to those instructions. That was our second thing. I actually think I need to get through the review first, and then you could ask me a question. But seeing that everybody remembers what we did last time, I want to make sure that we have that. And then the third idea, which we noted, is that this fits into the book-long theme of the importance of having principled leadership and leaders who are responsible for the community. And we saw it with Eli. When his kids veer and abuse power for themselves, then his family loses its right to, well, basically everything. And they're going to be destroyed ultimately. We saw it with Shmuel. When the people say that his sons are not following in his path, then they say we don't want them to inherit the position either. And now we're seeing it with Shaul. This is a very important message here, that the only way that this power can be passed down is in the event that you are going to be true to the God who is issuing that power in the first place. The last piece that we saw on that was to note the similarity between that story and two other stories in Tanakh. One, the golden calf, the Egel, because of this idea that we found in some of the commentators, he's waiting, God isn't doing it, and finally he gets up and he acts, only to find out, had you waited another day, he would have been fine. Look, Shmuel just showed up. That was one similarity, and then the other one, more germane in terms of the discussion about, you know, one strike and you're out, is Moshe hitting the rock. And the idea also, you didn't listen to my instructions, therefore you don't get to bring the Jews into the land. There it's not about inheriting the position. There it's about passing along there it's about himself carrying out the role. Yes. People can please turn off their phones. That would be great. Thanks.
Okay. I just wanted to say that at this point, not only he is being removed as king, but his descendant. And yet we find in Malachim, all those evil kings, Yehud, and The Davidic line continued right through to the Horban. I mean, so it doesn't always follow suit that what Shmuel said to Shaul is followed by the descendants of David.
Correct. The standards change as you go along. However, I would note, don't confuse Malchei Yehuda and Malchei Yisrael.
No, meaning, I'm not, but they're bad on both sides.
Malchei Yisrael are pretty much uniformly bad. It's hard to find a good king among Malchei Yisrael, among the kings of the northern kingdom. Malchei Yehuda, Chizkiyahu, Yoshiyahu, Asa, Yotam, it's true, I often quote the Rashi in Divrei Hayamim that lists the flaws for every king of Yehuda except for Yotam.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, despite the flaws that we identify, you talk about someone like Hizkiyahu or someone like Yoshiyahu, I wouldn't put them...
Zora and everything. That's
no, right. Hizkiyahu and Yoshiyahu?
No, not them, the bad kings.
The bad kings are bad, right? And then, of course, you have someone like Menashe, and what do I do with him?
Yeah, but what I'm saying is they were saved for the good king, and yet Shaul's line is wiped out immediately for his transgression.
Correct.
Not fair.
I didn't want to go there yet because I want to do that with David. The point was that David gets a promise from Hashem that his line is going to continue, and that's what changes the standard. That's what changes the way this works. But there's more to be said about that with David and his relationship with Hashem, which we're going to have to ultimately get to.
Also, Jonathan has shown that he's probably not really suitable to be king either. I mean, he's very...
So we are going to spend time on Yonatan, but we need more data on Yonatan. And God willing, today we're going to get more data. But we have to see a lot more about Yonatan in order to understand who this person is and what's going on. Shaul and David have an advantage or disadvantage, depending on how you look at it, in that people talk about them a lot. You absorb culturally certain ideas about Shaul and David just by dint of, if you have the benefit of going to a day school, but speeches in Shul on Shabbos, classes that you go to here and there. People talk about them so much so that you can never open up a book of Shmuel, and yet you can tell me a whole bunch of things about Shaul, like Amalek from the Haftorah before Purim, so therefore you know about that story, or Shaul's pursuit of David, which again is popularly known. With Yonatan, he's sort of a blank slate for a lot of people. Maybe they know that he protected David because of the Haftorah, for Machar Chodesh. But we need more information before we can talk intelligently about Yonatan.
In David's eulogy.
For those who have read it, correct. Yes.
So in terms of the whole setting him up to fail, I don't think it's necessarily setting him up to fail. It could just be this is the first opportunity, this is the first king. We might be making an example, show that holding him to higher standards, you do one little thing wrong, this is what's going to happen to you.
Yes. Yeah, no, it's true. Really, when you start, it's a fair point. Okay.
Is there a next one?
Okay. Yes, there is. There are a couple here. Okay. So that brings us to Pasuk Tedvav, chapter 13, sentence 15. Shaul got this news, and he is going to soldier on. And that's what we're going to find out here. The position of the Jews as the Plishtim attack, this is essentially a prelude to the battle. Vayakam Shmuel, Vayal min ha-Gilgal, Givat Binyamin. Shmuel got up, and he left. He went to Givat Binyamin. Vayivkot Shaul asaman imtzi'im imo kishish meyozish, and Shaul counts up what he's got left, and it's 600 men. V'Shaul v'Yonatan b'no v'ha'aman imtzi'im imam yoshvim b'geva Binyamin. Shaul, Yonatan, and his crew are sitting in Geva Binyamin, which we've talked about before. U'plishtim chanu b'mechmas, and the plishtim are in mechmas, we noted last time. The plishtim are in the place that Shaul thought was going to be, the royal seat. Vayetzei hamashchis, we're in Pasuk Yud Zayin, sentence 17. Vayetzei hamashchis mimachanei plishtim shlosha rashim. The plishtim attack, a three-pronged attack. They break themselves up into three different forces. Harosh echad yifne al derech ofra, el eretz shual. One of them towards ofra, sorry?
We need the bowls.
Well, I'm just going to give you the directions based on what the Dat Mikra tells me. To the Eretz Shual, presumably the land where the foxes are, that's northeast. V'harosh echad yifne derech Beit Choron. The second one goes towards Beit Choron, that's west. V'harosh echad yifne derech ha'gvul. And then the third one goes towards the border, east-southeast, meaning like towards the Yarden. Hanishkaf al Gehat Sivoim Hamidbara, which overlooks Gehat Sivoim, the valley or the depression of the Tzvoim. The Tzvoim are some kind of creature. They're identified in the Gemara. They're some kind of dangerous creature that lives in the desert. Sorry? Could be hyena. I've heard different words put on it, but I don't actually know of a firm Yehuda Felix type of statement definitively of what kind of creature. Yeah? Really? Wow. So they break up into three forces, and they're attacking in all directions, right? Northeast, west, east, south, east. That's a different one. There are two of them. I'm talking about the one who's most famous for his botany. Yeah. Okay. So the Plishtim are on the move. What about the Jews? The Jews have a problem. Pasuk Yud Tet. We're going to read, we'll read Yud Tet to Chav Gimel, 19 to 23. V'charash lo yimatzei b'chol eretz Yisrael. You don't have any metal workers, no smiths, among the Jews. Ki amru plishtim pen yasu ha'evrim cherev ochanit. Because the Plishtim said, we don't want the Jews to be able to create weapons, no swords and spears. Right? So it wasn't that no Jews became smiths because they didn't know how or weren't interested. If you became a smith, the Plishtim made sure you were no longer a smith. That was the way it worked. Vayerduchol Yisrael haplishtim l'tosh ish es machrashto ve'es eso ve'es kardumo ve'es machrashaso. So you'll say, well, wait a minute, if you don't have a smith, then what do you do for all your metal tools? And the answer is, side benefit for the Plishtim. Aside from military, this is also financial. If the Jews need to have a plow, any sort of a blade, a hatchet, whatever it's going to be, they have to go to the Plishtim to get them to fashion or sharpen the blade. He's listing for you all of the different types of tools. Yeah, it's very detailed. The dot maker gives you pictures that really have nothing to do with anything except that they're showing you, you know, metal blades or some version of it. But whatever it was that you wanted for any agricultural purpose, you relied on the Plishtim. So what that means is day of the war. That means he has got 3,000 men, or now he's got 600 men, who have no weapons. Who has it? Shaul has a weapon. Yonatan has a weapon. Somehow they managed to keep a weapon that they gave to the king and the king's son. And that's it. Vayetze matzav plishtim el ma'avar michmas. And the Plishtim are on the move. The forces of this governor, magistrate, consul, plenipotentiary, whatever you want to call him, his forces, they are on the move, and the Jews are out of luck. Now, they're not entirely out of luck. Rashi and Radak note that they did have weapons. They just don't have the ones you want, right? Take a look at source number one from Divrei Hayamim, describing the forces of David, his warriors. Noshke keshet, maiminim umas meilim ba'avanim uvachitzim ba'keshet. Bakashet. Those who were armed with the keshet, the bow, and those who were really skilled, they could sling rocks with their left or their right. Slingshots, exactly. Slingshots and bows and arrows. That's what they have. Presumably the arrow has a stone blade that you sharpened. This is a pretty severe limitation on military capacity. Mind you, we've seen this before. We've seen this before that the Jews did not have weapons. Shirat Devorah in source number two. She says, Yivchar Elohim, that's Elohim, not Elohim. Yivchar Elohim Chadoshim, they chose new gods. She's describing the Jews living under the Canaanites in her day. She says, because they chose the Avodah Zarah, the idolatry. Az Lechem She'arim, then Lechem Milchama, war, came to the gates. Maginim Yeraeva Romach Barbaim Elef B'Israel. You could look among 40,000 Jews and you wouldn't find a sword. You wouldn't find a shield. out of luck.
Shavari, something, Shimshon, like everyone needs different things.
And correct. And this is something that we've made the point about, we made the point throughout Shoftim, that we have these unarmed or weirdly armed leaders, right? Shimshon's got the jawbone of the donkey, and Shamgar's got the cattle goad, and Yael takes the tent spike, Ehud with his personal customized dagger. To me, it's very clear that you have this message, which is perhaps best summarized in Tehillim Perek Chaf. Eilev Arecha ve'eilev Asusim Anach L'B'Shem Hashem Elokeinu Nazkir. It's a statement of faith. Not only do we believe, not only does the enemy make sure we don't have weapons, but we say in response, we don't need weapons. God will take care of it no matter what. Just like God could help us no matter who the leader was in the time of the Shoftim, so too God can help us even if we don't have weapons. Now, you do have a little bit of a problem, which Abarbanel points out in source number 3. We had a war with the Plishtim already. That's what you're going to ask, Susan. Okay. We had a war with the Plishtim back in, what was it, Perek Zion or so. Right? Shmuel was victorious. So Abarbanel says, yeah. B'yos she'Shmuel nilcham ba'Plishtim in source number 3. He says, although Shmuel did fight Plishtim, hinei le'yosa moshlim ba'em kodem lezeh shanim rabos v'mei Shimshon ve'eli. He says, the Plishtim had ruled over us for a long time before that, right? Through the period of Eli. Right, which was a very long time. As well as Shimshon, remember, Abarbanel is of the belief that Shimshon's story, everybody agrees. Shimshon's story is basically right before Eli. The only question is where you put Pesalmicha and Pilegesh Begivah. That's a machlokes. But Shimshon is then also, and during the time of Shimshon, the Jews are living under the Plishtim. Shimshon is not a leader of an army. Shimshon is a sole raider who does a lot of damage. But the Jews are under Plishti control. And after Shmuel's old age, the Plishtim had these, whatever you want to call them, Nitzivim, in the land. So he says, before Shmuel's time, the Plishtim have been in control for a long time, and they've been able to implement their rule that we don't get to have weapons and we don't get to have smiths. And then Siper sheyatza matzav achad migiborei haplishtim. So I'm sorry, actually the next line of Barbanel I'm not ready for yet. But his point is to say that the Plishtim were in control for a long time, and even if Shmuel was able to get something together with weapons in his battle that he had in Perek Zion, ultimately, they don't really have anything to be able to fight the Plishtim. So the Plishtim move forward, and they are ready to attack. And that's the second half of this Abarbanel, where he says, "Siper sheyatza matzav echad migiborei haplishtim v'hu rosh sarei hachayo." He says, one of these rulers, governors, whatever they are, the head of their military officers, move forward. V'yatza mimichmas asher hayu kulam chonim. Sham he left mechmas, where their forces had been camped. L'iskarev el hagivah asher hayu sham ha-shaul v'yonasan b'no. And he is moving against Givah. So the message here, we spent a lot of psukim on this, right? 15 to 23. We spent a lot of time explaining that they don't have weapons. The key here is to teach us that victory cannot be natural. Victory is going to come from God. Yonatan has put them in this position of being weak and facing a superior enemy. Shaul may have made it worse by failing to follow the instructions that Shmuel gave him. And by the way, we have no weapons. Yeah.
Oh, this is like a deja vu from what happened. I've got to bring it up with the
67.
War of Independence.
Oh, I thought you were saying 67.
I mean, you thinking that too? I mean, it's like so.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So moving. I mean, there they were with all these enemies around, mm-hmm. armed to the teeth, and Israel trying to get a tank from here and a few guns from
some
here.
Some Czechoslovakian,
a little bit here, and Jews in New York are smuggling in whatever they can, and the bullet factory in Rehovot is doing what they can. And God helped. We hope they're going to cry. It's like
so
unbelievable.
So Ralbag uses this for his introduction to the next section, because believe it or not, it's going to get worse. And again, we need more data about Yonatan, in order to really understand. But what we're going to see happen with Yonatan here is that he is going to decide to launch a raid personally, on his own. Completely. Yes. Take a look at... Sorry. You'll see. Take a look at source number 4. Ralbag says, introducing this story. Yes, and that worked out really well. V'zeh sipur kulo bala horot, ki lo b'cheru v'chanit Yehoshia Hashem. He says, the point of this story is to show you, you're not going to win through weapons. That's not how God works. Halo tirek, Yonatan levado, im nosei kelav, hayu k'neged hachel harav hazeh, Yonatan, alone, along with his armor-bearer, goes up against this great force. V'nasan Hashem, shua g'dola b'yado, spoiler alert, Hashem is going to give him great victory. So we're going to see this play out now. So let's read the opening 5 psukim and see just what Yonatan decides to do. Vayhi hayom, and it was that day. Vayomer Yonatan ben Shaul el hanar nosei kelav. Yonatan says to his youth, the bearer of his weapons, lechav nabara el matzav plishtim. Let's go to where the Plishti warriors are. Asher me'ever halah is over on that side. Uli aviv lo higid. He doesn't tell his father. V'Shaul yoshev b'kteh ha'givah tachas harimon asher b'migron. Shaul is at the edge of Givah, underneath the pomegranate in Migron. V'ha'am asher imo k'shesh me'oz ish. He has about 600 people with him. V'achiya ben achituv, achi I kavod, ben Pinchas ben Eli. Kohen Hashem Bishilo Nosei Evod. Achiya, son of Achituv, the brother of Ikavod. Now you have to read this carefully. Who was a son of Pinchas, who was the son of Eli, who was the Kohen Hashem in Shiloh. Now, Kohen Hashem Bishilo is not describing Achiya, it's describing Eli. And you know this because Shiloh is gone. No one is the Kohen Hashem B'Shiloh at this point. So it's about Eli. This fellow Achiya was the Nosei Ephod, the carrier of the Ephod. More on that shortly. The Ha'am lo yada ki alach Yonatan. Not only does Shaul not know, nobody knows what Yonatan is about to do. We're just going to read the Pesukim first, and then we'll ask the questions about them. Uvein ha-maveros, asher bikesh Yonatan la-avroa matzav plishtim. He says, at the crossing, the place where you'd be able to get from one point to the other, meaning where the Jews are to where the plishtim are, where Yonatan wants to cross, you had Shein Hasela Meha'ever Mizeh, Veshein Hasela Meha'ever Mizeh. You've got a big boulder on one side and a big boulder on the other side. Veshem Ha'echad Botzeitz, Veshem Ha'echad Seneh. One of them was named Botzeitz, and one of them was named Seneh. Why are we naming rocks? Good question. Hashen ha'echad matzuk mitzafon mul michmas v'echad minegev mul gava. One of them is on the north side, on the michmas side of it, and one of them is on the south side, at or next to geva, on the geva side of it fundamentally. So here's a little picture here of Ma'avar Michmas. This is somebody's painting. This is not like a photograph. I don't know what it is. I don't know when it's from. You can't see anything here if you look at it up front.
There's a lot of details here. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm thinking Skilla and Charybdis. You know, it's like you have these two big stones on either side. Okay. What's strange here?
A lot of details.
A lot of details in the... I thought you meant details in the picture.
Here there's a passing over entire periods, and then here they're describing. But I had something else to say, if I may.
Yes, please do.
Is it Achiya ben Achitu?
Yes.
He's a descendant of Eli.
Yes, he is.
But it was...
Yes, he is. He certainly is a descendant of Eli.
So he's a young grandfather.
No, his brother. It's from the brother's
side. Ikavod was his uncle.
Yeah.
I mean, Ikavod... Hang on. Let's get his brother. Sorry, correct.
Yeah. He married the Ephod. But is a descendant of Eli? They're not
carrying the Ephod, correct. Yeah. And, yes?
From what I remember, the mother of Ikavod... We married. and then he was born.
The mother of Ichabod died when Ichabod was born. Remember? That was Pinchas' daughter. He's the older brother of Ichabod. Yeah.
So how come he's got the Ephod? How come?
So this is what we have to talk about, but this is a good question. It's a good question, which we're going to have to address. What else is odd here? The names of the rocks is for sure odd, right? Why are we naming rocks? And why does Yonatan want to do this alone? Why doesn't he tell anybody? What is he thinking? Is
trying to redeem himself from himself.
Yeah, really, this way? The whole thing is very, very strange. So let's go through this bit by bit. So Abarbanel and Malbim take the view, which we have already articulated, which is that this is God's doing. Hashem is using Yonatan. Take a look at source number 5, a one-line thing from Abarbanel. Shehi'ir Hashem, Esruach Yonatan, Va'amar Elanar, Nosei Kilav, L'cha V'navar. The Abarbanel says Hashem is the one who is moving Yonatan into place. This is reminiscent of what we saw with Shimshon. Remember that when Shimshon first gets involved with a Plishti woman, right, the first Plishti woman that he's involved with, the one he marries. So we said that Hashem is arranging this, ki ta'anahu mevakesh. Hashem was looking for a way to get at the Plishtim, and he's using Shimshon in that. If you take a look at source number 6, I brought you the Abarbanel from Shoftim. He says, matzanu pa'amim rabot b'sipurei ha'nevi'im. He says, you find many times in the stories of the prophets, bless you, that they occasionally went against the rules. So that ultimately the service of God would emerge. Like Eliyahu and Har HaKarmel, who brings a karban, even though you have a Beis HaMikdash, and therefore you should not be bringing karbanos on Har HaKarmel. Nonetheless, there's a need at that moment. He's not saying that Shimshon. Well, let's read it. He's v'chein ra'oishin amar b'inyan Shimshon sh'asad dvarim asher lo chedin l'fi sheyimatzei ta'ana lihid or sheyimtza ta'ana lihinat kem miplishtim. He says it's appropriate to say the same thing about Shimshon, that he did certain things that were against the rules. In order to find a claim for revenge against the Plishtim. Especially when, as far as Abarbanel is concerned, Shimshon is not the brightest of the Shoftim. He uses that phrase, he did not have a complete mind. It's the sort of thing that you don't say anywhere near earshot of Shimshon. But he's not the only one to say this. We saw others who made that comment about Shimshon when we read the Psukim where Shmuel made the contrasts, comparison/contrast of Moshe, Aaron, Shmuel versus Yiftach, Shimshon, and Gidon. The message that you get here from Abarbanel is, number one, some of the things he did were out of line, but they were for the sake of leading to a good end. And also, he doesn't really have direct access to Hashem as others did. Hashem put him in position in order to be able to act against the Plishtim. So even though Shimshon should not be messing around getting involved with Plishti women, nonetheless, Hashem enables this to happen in order to get where he needs to go. The point is that Hashem is willing to use them as tools in order to get to a particular end. And if you will say, wait a minute, what happened to free will? What about that? So I would apply the Rambam's formulation for how Nevuah and Ruach HaKodesh work. The Rambam says, we've quoted it before, that the lowest level of Nevuah is where a person has a desire that they would do anyway, and Hashem simply strengthens it to get them to move. Hashem is not getting them to act against their inclination. He is simply reinforcing the natural inclination, giving it a boost. We talked about this regarding, in the positive sense, Moshe at the well, and how Moshe acts against his own interests by helping the daughters of Yisro at the well. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. For someone who's a fugitive, who just escaped Egypt, where he thinks that they all want to kill him, to show up in Midian and start a fight at a bar.
But it's an innate sense of
justice. Innate sense of justice is great, but it's
with at least three and
sure, but it's suicidal. He fled Egypt for a reason. He didn't go that far. Midian is not
like
that far.
It's an instinct that comes out when he's
so precisely, but it's an instinct that normally he would have squelched, but Hashem is strengthening within him because this is the end that Hashem wants him to achieve. That's the idea. I'm sorry.
What's the difference between that and what Shmuel did with Shaul?
What do you mean? Because I don't think we ever find in Tanakh, and please give me a case if you know of one, a case in which somebody is punished for doing something that Hashem made him do. With Paro, we explicitly say that it's not so, that he's punished for the things he did before his heart was hardened, not for the things that are afterwards.
No, I'm thinking of his inclination was...
Yeah, I understand, but we don't have any cases in which somebody is punished for doing something that he didn't want to do, but that he was compelled to do. If anyone can come up with one,
Even Shimshon, he gets blinded, they poke out his eyes.
That's
not punishment?
No, this is what the plishtim did to him. You're saying that's a divine punishment. I mean, the truth is, there is a Gemara that reads it as punishment for him following his eyes. I shouldn't discount that.
So what we're saying is,
I'm saying that you will not get zapped for something that you wouldn't have done if not for Hashem's involvement. People will get rewarded for a good desire to do something. Yes. Even
positive,
hopefully. I mean, there's more to say on this, but I'm comfortable with that statement. By the way, the Gemara in Sota, which I brought you in number 7, supports this idea. When it talks about Shimshon's... Sorry. Go ahead.
In answer, I don't think it's actually strange at all that Yonatan doesn't consult with Saul. Because what we've seen in the previous paragraphs is about your dynasty. And part of your dynasty is that it's been cut. It's clear that Saul is not the father that he should be. He hasn't obeyed Hashem. And so why would he consult with someone? Why would he consult with his father, who has clearly not been able to fulfill Hashem's wishes?
That's interesting. Does Yonatan view this as a, his father failed? This demands that we answer the question of who knows about Shmuel's conversation with Shaul. Uh-huh. In other words, this assumes that Yonatan is aware of that.
He may not be aware necessarily of truth, but he may not necessarily be aware of the discussion, but he may be aware of the actions, and so he may have been a party to the fact that Saul was supposed to wait this certain amount of time. He disobeyed Hashem, and so Yonatan is not going to consult his father as to how he should act.
Interesting. Well, let's see how that plays out. I mean,
so it's not like you can see that something was wrong. He was supposed to sit in 2 carbonara and give. Because of the fact that he left and did nothing.
Well, Yonatan wouldn't necessarily know that either. That's the problem. Meaning, the original instruction that was given to Shaul was only given to Shaul. So I don't know what he knows and when he knows it, but it's an interesting idea. Let's see how things play out. It will not address the question of why the nation doesn't know what Yonatan is doing, because it's not just Shaul who doesn't know. Nobody knows. But it's an interesting thought, and we'll see how it plays out, because it would help to explain Yonatan's involvement with David. But again, I want to see more before we address Yonatan.
But already not consulted his father.
Correct.
The commissioner.
Correct, which was before he was cut.
The last time was before the...
Beforehand. Correct. But it's still an interesting thought, and I think it definitely bears thinking about. But I just wanted to show you in number 7, support for the idea that what Shimshon did was Hashem strengthening his own will. He thought he was acting on his own. the Gemara says when Shimshon has this first Plishti woman he becomes involved with, his father or mother didn't know it was from God. But ki azal mi abasa yashruse azal. When he went, he did it thinking that it was because I like her, because I think she's good. He didn't think that he was being controlled. So this business with Yonatan, though, of not telling Shaul. So the commentators seem to assume that the text is not saying he was trying to fool everybody, but rather that it's trying to explain why he was alone. Why wasn't anybody with him? Because he hadn't told anybody. So take a look at source number 8, where the Ralbag says, if Ha'am lo yadaki alach Yonasan, the nation didn't know Yonasan had gone. Amnam amar zeshim yadu ha'yuholchem imo. Because had they known, they would have accompanied him. But that doesn't answer the question of, so why didn't he tell? Is this intentional? Is he afraid that they're going to stop him? You know, we don't want the prince to go out on his own like this. Is it because he felt like he'd do better if he was just small force, one or two people, undetected. You know, undetected and all of that? Ricky?
It sounded like he's doing recon.
Except he's going to do more than recon.
Well, from the very first few words, it sounds like recon.
So Malcolm is with Ricky. Malcolm is with Ricky and suggests that, indeed, he wasn't planning an attack at this stage. Take a look at source number 9. He quotes you the pasuk in which Yonatan spoke to his armor bearer, in which he said, "Lachav nabara matzav plishtim." Right, let's go cross to where they are. As lo hayadato adayin lihilachem bam. He didn't intend to fight them at that point. Rak lavor la'eber shnegin matzav plishtim. He wanted to cross over to the other side that would be near them. Ki nichmas hayam itzafon legeva. Because Michmas is north of Geva, right? We read that in the Psukim. V'shol v'yonatan amdu b'tzad darom shol Geva. Shol and Yonatan had been on the south side. So he said, let me cross over to the north side. V'lachein l'aviv lo hikid. And that's why he didn't tell his father. Ki lo yadato adayin el ha-gvura she'yisorer alav achar kach. He was not yet planning on doing that which he was ultimately going to do.
Yeah,
he's doing recon exactly. I just want to keep on reading in the
matzav means situation.
No, matzav is the matzav haplishtim that we've been talking about all along. This governor position, whatever it is, it doesn't mean location. Shav, and it continues. He says in his commentary to Pasuk Gimel, after Pasuk Bet, where we got just basic layout information, where we said Shaul was sitting here and he had 600 men, and Achiyah ben Achituv, Shabel Sipuro, Shayonasan lo hayadato az, el sheyipol b'machane plishtim. Yonatan did not expect to fall upon the Plishti camp at this point, and he says, I'll prove it to you. Allah, first of all, mitzah shlo yigid le'aviv. He didn't tell his father. V'lo hayo said devar gadol kazeh biladav. He is not in the Netz camp on this. He says, you wouldn't do that without telling your father. That's first of all. Bet, shaya sham urim v'tumimi mahem. V'yashoel b'ashem. He says, carrying the ephod doesn't mean he has a nice jacket. The ephod is with the Urim Betumim, the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol. Whether he is, whether Achiyah is the Kohen Gadol or not is not clear. But he has the Urim Betumim, which we'll see later on in Shmuel. You consult when you want to do something like this, and he didn't do that either. And third, Shagam Ha'am lo yadaki alach Yonasan. The nation didn't know. The army didn't know that Yonasan had gone. V'chol ze raya shaloya b'machshav aso ad lasos no ra'os. He wasn't planning on doing some kind of awesome thing now. Shimken hayam ya'edes ha'am liyos nechonim acharav. Because then he would have told everybody, hey, get ready. Even if they're not going to accompany him, even if he thinks he can do this alone, he would at least alert them that a raid is going to happen. It's generally a good idea. Right? At the very least, the army spokesman can be ready to explain to the world why Israel isn't really bad after the attack. Yes.
Also, there might have been some spies. He didn't want people to know he's going there because he's going on his own.
That's interesting. Concern for espionage. No, it's an interesting question. I don't recall it ever being discussed. I don't remember any story in Tanakh where there's a concern about the enemy having a spy among the Jews. But I was
just surveillance.
We had no, because we had people who were. We did in Yeshaya on you were there on Tuesday, but we talked about Shevna among the Jews in Yehuda who were he was agitating on behalf of the Assyrians. So, like, we did have people who you could have looked at that way, but I don't know. Maybe he has that concern. Malbim thinks that he doesn't tell anybody because he's not planning anything. Abarbanel is more opaque. If you look at Abarbanel in number 10, he doesn't really say, but look at his wording. Ha'am lo yada ki alach Yonatan me'amachane. The nation doesn't know Yonatan is gone. Ki lo sha'alu alav lekohen velo yadu davar. Because he didn't ask the Kohen about it, and so nobody knew. And it sounds to me, and maybe I'm overreading, but it sounds to me like he's imputing a level of intent. It's not just a statement of fact. The way I read Ralbag, in source number 8, I don't know, I feel like there's a statement here of a level of intent.
Could be the precursor of the Malbim. In the sense that it doesn't say anything, but then the Malbim could elaborate on Abarbanel, which isn't going to happen, and say, no, he wasn't really going to fight, he was just going to explore.
Right. I mean, from a methodology standpoint, there's nothing wrong with saying that, meaning Malbim does often quote Abarbanel or expand on Abarbanel, right. So that could be.
Yeah.
Ricky?
Maybe he didn't ask the Kohen because he didn't want anybody to know.
Well, that's the question, though. Our question is not what he did. Our question is why.
Right.
And I think we need more data still about Yonatan. I think this has to be read as part of a bigger picture. Because right now we have, as was noted, two stories of him going it alone.
Yeah.
And we don't understand yet. Yeah. I don't have a solid answer for why.
Is there any commentary on why he killed the big shot, the governor?
Yeah, we talked about it last week, though. You have to catch the audio. We did do that.
Okay.
Let's take a look, though, at Achia. This fellow Achia is introduced in this very interesting way, right? Why did you give me his whole family story? Achia, son of Achitub, I don't know the name of the armor bearer. He's going to be a pretty important man, you know? Why is it that for Achia, not only do I get his name, but I get his father's name, I get Ikavod. By the way, he is the nephew of Ikavod. I said it right. Achia is the son of Achitub. Achitub is the brother of Ikavod. And Achitub and Ikavod are the sons of Pinchas, who is the son of Eli, which means I have Achia, I have Achitub, his father, I have Pinchas, his grandfather, and Eli, the great-grandfather. I mean, he's carrying the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol, and he's not doing anything with it. I brought you all this in order to say no one asked him what to do. Yeah.
He legitimately has it.
Given him as Yichus. Well, take a look at number 11.
Is it Yichus with the Pinchas?
Oh, well, so it's not just great Yichus necessarily. Radak says the only reason to do it is because we never met Achia before, but we know who Ikavod is. And therefore, we want to mention, just to orient you, about who this Kohen is.
And they didn't give us an introduction to
that. That's true. We didn't even bother to say Yonatan ben Shaul. It's true, Ricky.
But I thought Eli's family was going to lose all hold on being a Kohen Gadol.
And that's what you had before, and we are going to get there. But take a look first at source number 11. The Gemara in Shabbos. This is the discussion which we quoted when we learned about the sons of Eli. The discussion of whether they did anything wrong or did not do anything wrong. So Rav says, Pinchas lo chata. Remember, Eli has two sons, Chofni and Pinchas. All the sins that you saw in the Psukim and that we discussed were Chofni, not Pinchas. How does he get that? Very simple. The Pasuk says, Achia ben Achituv, Achi Kavod, etc. Right? This whole thing that we read. Esher Chet Baliyado Vakasim Yachso. If this person had really sinned, if Pinchas had really sinned, would the text list his lineage, meaning to identify him in this way? If he was a bad guy, we would say, as they quote here, Valo Kvar Ne'amar. The Pasuk in Malachi says, Yachreis Hashem Leish Asher Ya'asana Er Ve'oname Ohale Yaakov Umagish Mincha L'Hashem Tzvakot. That somebody who does this, and it's abusing the Karbanot, which is exactly the accusation against Chofni and Pinchas, someone who does this will be cut off from the tents of Yaakov. So, what does that mean? Im Yisrael hu lo yeh lo er b'chachamim v'lo oneh b'talmidim. If he's not a Kohen, someone who abuses the Mishkan, someone who abuses the Beis HaMikdash, so he will not have anyone among the sages from him. And if he's a Kohen, lo yeh lo ben magish mincha. He will not have a son who brings an offering. And yet, we list Pinchas and his grandson, or whatever, his grandson, is holding the ephod. Elav shmamina Pinchas lo chata. The answer has to be that Pinchas didn't sin. Well, if he didn't sin, why did it say he did? Avol mitoch shahay, I added the word ba'avol. Mitoch shahay lo Pinchas limchos lechafni, v'lo micha male alav akasov ki'ilu chata. Because there's no such thing as an innocent bystander. If you're aware that your brother is abusing his power in the Mishkan, and you don't say anything, you are considered a collaborator. That's the indictment. But he personally, where we find out here, is not guilty. And that would be answer number one for Ricky's question about how does he have this role, but it's an insufficient answer. Because there's still a curse on the house of Eli. And Pinchas may be righteous, but you know what? So were Abaye and Rabba in the Gemara, and we're told that they're also subject to that and have to earn their way towards a delay of their deaths. So Radak gives a different answer. Number 12. Radak says, Abo b'melchama hazos, in this war, Shahaya Achia nosei ephod, where Achia is carrying the ephod, via tov lifnei Hashem, and he was good before God, haya davar behefech v'yisachu agadola b'Yisrael, it was the opposite, causing great salvation for Israel. In other words, what Radak says, and Abarbanel brings it as well, is that this is a positive reversal for the family. We last met them with ikavod, and the disgrace and loss of the Aron. But Hashem likes Achia, and he will succeed, and the klala, the curse, is on hold. That's the idea. Okay. So he is the Nosei Ephod. As I said, I'm not sure if he's the Kohen Gadol, but he's got the Ephod in the Urim Vitumim, so he might as well be, for all intents and purposes. I don't know if he's the Kohen who leads the people to war. I don't know. We're not given enough information. I looked in the commentaries to see, and none of them was willing to go out on a limb with this. So Yonatan and his armor bearer head off to the Plishtim, and now, if you look at Pasuk Dalet, Uvena Maberos Asher Bikesh Yonatan La'avor Al Matzav Plishtim. Right? Where we talk about the spot where you cross, and we say that Yonatan wanted to go to the Plishtim, so Malbim says this is the point where he has the Ruach Hashem pushing him. Now, initially he didn't want to go. Initially he's just doing recon. Now he says, you know what? Wouldn't it be great if we could just do a surprise attack on the Plishtim? And we mentioned these stones. What's with these stones? So first of all, they have to be mentioned. Because in Pasuk Yud Gimel, when Yonatan launches his attack, he climbs up these stones. So we're orienting you about it. But not only that, the stones are going to be important because, at least within Malbim's view, I think it's Malbim, it's either Malbim or Ralbag, hang on, it will explain how it is that he was able to defeat the Plishtim. What he's going to do, yeah, it's Malbim, is he's going to take advantage of the power of surprise. As Malbim reads it, he doesn't go the normal path along the road to ascend to them. He takes them by surprise by climbing over these large stones. So we need to orient you to it. And that's what Malbim explains as far as why these stones have names. No one I've seen gives like a lot of discussion of the names themselves, except that the Targum is going to say that that the first name, was it Betzer? No, Botzeis, means slick. No, boats is mud. I wonder if they meet as an association. But boats means sign is slick. And that's going to explain why when we describe Yonatan ascending over the stones, he has to climb with his hands and feet.
Rocks.
Because this is, sorry?
Rocks.
Yeah. Because rocks, stones, same thing. I think. Because they're hard to climb. And that's what Malbim says here, just one second. If you look at number 13, he says, Hayu Sham Shine Slaim Gvohim Mafsikim Beinehem. Yeah, these two large boulders. that divided between the Plishtim and the Jews. They were so large that they were like geographic features, and therefore they were identified the same way that a mountain, right, is Mount Washington or Mount this or Mount that. So that's what they called these stones. They were landmarks. Okay. Yes. Someone was going to ask something before.
So what kind of surprise can he give, like, on his own?
So wait and see. Wait and see. You're right, but wait and see. Susan.
I'm just thinking, I'm thinking of who did he ask, but obviously from my translation it's not.
Yes.
But
right, so the word levakesh does not necessarily mean to ask. It means really it's more of to want. Yes. We often use it as to ask, and it's not wrong in the sense that you find people asking things, and, David HaMelech says, osa avakesh, which could be read as I want, but also he's putting it in words, so he's asking. You know, Shifti Bebet Hashem, and so on. But think about when Yosef goes looking for his brothers. He says, Et achai anochi mevakesh. Right? I'm not asking for them, I'm seeking them. Yeah.
Oh, that's right, to ask for, seek.
Yeah, precisely. So, in summary, the Jews are in danger. That's clear. They can't win naturally. They don't have weapons. They're a tiny force. Those who they do have, largely on the run. And Yonatan moves into position to catalyze a divine victory, knowingly or not, intentionally or not. And we have to see where this is going to take us. One thing that I've been thinking about doing, I don't know, it adds a layer of work, but it might be worthwhile. I started thinking about this the other day, would be adding, like, at the end of the sheets, like, a couple of review questions for people. I mentioned it in the Yeshaya Shir also. I'm not interested in grading. I don't want anybody to send me their answers for checking. I am not doing that. But I just think that it would be a good idea for people to have at the end of a Shir to be able to just, you know, see for themselves, did I get it? So to speak. I'm thinking about doing that. We'll see.
Maybe.
It is. That's the problem, is that it's work.
We don't want homework. Thank you.
Just do a summary.
That shouldn't mean your work. Yeah.
Maybe just do a summary at the end.
So that's what I do verbally.
Right.
You know? Okay, like, if I put it on the sheet, then it makes it too easy for people not to listen to the audio. Okay. Yeah? Right. Further questions are easy. I could give you further questions as long as the day is. You know, I could give you all sorts of further questions. It's a little harder to come up with good questions that help you to make sure you got it. But at the same time, I feel like it would make the experience more nutritious. Yeah. I don't know. Okay, we'll see. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Have a good Shabbos, and God willing, we'll resume here next week.